cooperation over chaos. We are all in this together.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
You're listening to the Sustainable Hour podcast. We'd like to start off, as always, by acknowledging that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to their elders, past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We're on stolen land, land that was never ceded, always was and always will be First Nations land. We need to listen to the ancient wisdom that they acquired by nurturing both their communities and their country before it was stolen by the first white colonisers. In that ancient wisdom, there's so much of the information that we're going to need as we navigate the climate crisis. We need to take that seriously because they did that for so long.
The world is changing around us, and certainly here in Europe, where I am at the moment, I can tell you everyone's talking about, again now, the right-wing politics moving in. We're seeing it in the UK and in France, and now with the landslide election in Germany, where a party similar to One Nation has won a major election victory this week. And of course, inside the climate movement and among all the environment groups here in Europe, people are talking now about how do they respond, because this is certainly not looking good for the energy transition, the action on climate. These right-wing parties are exactly like Pauline Hanson, very much against renewable energy and against any type of climate policies. So what are we going to do about it? That's a question which we'll be talking about today in the Sustainable Hour. But first of all, we need to hear what else has been happening around the world. And for that, we are privileged to have Colin Mockett, OAM, at the news desk. Colin, you have the global outlook for us, so let's hear what you have taken notice of this week.
Thank you, Mick. And my roundup this week begins in the UN headquarters in New York, where a new UN Environment Programme report admitted that the world has lost any chance of holding global warming to 1.5 degrees, as was agreed in the Paris Treaty. Now, the UN realist scientists are predicting temperatures will reach 2.6 degrees by the end of the century, if all governments continue with their current policies. That temperature rise would have catastrophic consequences for the world, significantly increasing risks, including the collapse of the West Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets and the destruction of the Amazon rainforests, the report said. A further danger would be changes to the Atlantic meridian overturning circulation, the vast ocean current that helps regulate the world's climate by redistributing heat around the globe. Now, in the light of this, Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and our Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen, who were in Palau attending the Pacific Islands Forum, faced down Vanuatu's Climate Change Minister, Ralph Reganvanu, who called on Australia specifically to stop expanding its fossil fuel extraction and exporting. Australia is not doing enough, he said. Australia is a major producer of fossil fuels. We all know fossil fuels are the primary driver of the climate crisis, as I said. So the very least a country like Australia should be doing is stopping future expansion, and it's not doing that. When asked about this criticism, Anthony Albanese said Australia's Pacific neighbours had not raised objections during their forum talks. Australia is highly regarded when it comes to climate change, and the talking down of Australia does not happen from outside Australia, he said, in answer to the talking down of Australia by the climate minister. The Pacific leaders have respect for the position that we're taking, and they also understand with the transition because they're dealing with it as well, that the transition can't happen overnight, that it requires strategies and policies to be put in place. And one of these things that renewables require is firming capacity, and gas has a role to play in firming capacity. Now, that's our Prime Minister's measured response to climate change. And our politicians wonder why we don't trust them anymore. That was his answer to a direct criticism. But back to the UN report. The most optimistic pathway said it would see the average global temperature arrested at 1.8 degrees later this century before slowly being driven down. Now, that's what would occur if all governments managed to fully implement all of their current national climate plans and meet all long-term net zero targets. At present, there is a persistent gap between the emissions reductions countries have pledged and the policies in place to deliver them, says the report, in a section that was headed Limiting Overshoot, Navigating Exceedance at 1.5 degrees centigrade and pathways towards return. But even this came with a warning. Exceedance of 1.5 degrees Celsius should not be interpreted as safe or acceptable. There are no benign scenarios with global temperature rise above this level, the report said. Now, practically all the Pacific Forum members were among the nations that successfully lobbied for the world to adopt the 1.5 degree target, as crucial to their very existence during the Paris negotiations. And Australia has apparently championed their cause ever since. That's because it looks to maintain its security influence around the region. Now, this was taken on board in the UN report. In Pacific Atoll states such as Tuvalu and Kiribati, the loss of habituality is a present reality occurring well before total physical submersion, the report states. And the host of the Pacific Island Forum, which was a week ago now, Palau President Somenjel Whips Jr., said of the report, "It is hard to overstate the depth of emotion for those of us living on the front line after having fought so hard to put the 1.5 degree limit at the heart of the Paris Agreement. It is a further glimpse into a perilous future that has already arrived. To continue to have a fighting chance calls for greater ambition and no longer enough. We need to see an urgent and unprecedented increase in political will and investment in a climate-safe future. Nobody can read this report and conclude otherwise." Now, asked to comment on this, our Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said it was clear all nations needed to take more action. Climate change is real. The science is real. The action that is required is real as well, and the economic cost of inaction is real, he said. So we can expect some action, do you think? But the final word should go to Nepal's Prime Minister, Balendra Shah, who said, "The floods in the Bahukikoshi River in Rasuwa are not an ordinary flood," he said. "It was one of the region's major disasters, triggered by an avalanche of snow and ice in the Himalayan region. The people of Nepal are one of the major victims of the changing climate and its impact, even though they contribute less than 0.01% of the carbon pollution that is causing the warming. He added that Nepal's glaciers have lost almost a third of their volume in the past 30 years due to global warming, which the United Nations reported in 2023. The rooftops of the world are caving in, said UN Chief Antonio Guterres at the time. Nearly 2 billion people across Asia rely on the annual summer melt from those glaciers to sustain agriculture and generate power. And we thought that the climate change effects in the northern summer, with Europe currently experiencing its fifth heat wave and fires are still burning in the Americas, we thought that they were the things to worry about. What we should be worrying about is global leaders, including our own, who talk as if they're doing something and then carrying on backing fossil fuel burning as if no danger existed at all. And that caustic assessment ends my roundup for this week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our guest today is Tim Hollow. Tim's very much a friend of the Sustainable Hour. He's been on a number of times. He's a long-time climate activist. He's an author. He started off Green Music, and he's currently taken time off from all of that to complete a PhD. So thanks for coming on, Tim. Tell us what's up front for you at the moment.
Well, I guess what's really up front for me, and as you say, the kind of the reason why I've taken a bit of a step back to do some research is, I think like a lot of people I speak to, I'm looking at the world at the moment, and we're obviously seeing, as we just heard in the roundup, we're seeing the climate crisis that many of us have been expecting for a long time is here with us right now. And at the same time, there was always a bit of a myth, I think, around the place that when the poo really started to hit the fans, people would actually wake up and change would happen, and change would happen fast. And I think it was always something of a myth, but it was a myth that we all sort of held on to quite tightly. And what we're seeing is that the opposite is the case, and that the more that things are shaking, the more that the earth is moving under us, the tighter we're kind of holding on to old ways of being. And so what I am really wanting to do is think very deeply and talk to people around the place, around Australia and elsewhere around the world, about what are some of the things that we can think about doing that help us to let go, actually. We think a lot about how do we make the world that we want. And there's a lot of people doing wonderful work about making the world that we want. But we don't really think very much about how do we let go of the old? That's my really big question. How do we actually let go of our tight hold on the old ways of being and doing?
That's a really neat little conundrum, Tim. I've no doubt that the speed of change has really heated up over the course of the last 6 months in Australia. But that's basically because people have been buying electric cars because of the oil crisis in the Middle East. And it's put things front of mind of people, and they're thinking, well, I can do something about it. So something is changing, but it's not for the right reasons. It's not because we want to stop global warming. It's because petrol's got short and expensive. How on earth can you get through to people and say, look, there's more to it than the price of filling your tank? We've got to save the planet.
So it's interesting. I don't really mind why people do things, as long as they do things that will put us in the right direction. But I think there is nevertheless the conundrum, as you put it, that we've got to do a lot more than simply swapping out to EVs, for instance. Not that that's not a good thing to do, but we have to do a lot more than that. And what we have to do is learn to live in harmony with the natural world again. And we need to do that much more deeply than, in fact, in some ways we've ever done, because we've never lived as a species in a world where the natural environment that we're part of is changing as rapidly as it is already and is going to do for the rest of our lives. So I don't really mind why people do it. And so this is one of the things that I've been thinking about, in fact, is precisely this, is how do we think about not in fact how we convince people to do it, but what are some of the practices that we can think about doing that shift the way we think about the world by doing the practices? So, for instance, I'm thinking a lot about, I've been on this show before talking about my work around democracy and how we improve democracy in my book, Living Democracy. And what's really at the core of that is this idea that actually democracy is a practice. Democracy is a living practice. It's not just how we vote every now and then. It's not just elections. It's not even just kind of making law. It's a living practice of how we live together, how we engage with difficult questions together and work through difficult moments together so that we can come out the other side stronger as a community. And I think the best way of improving our democracy is by doing it, is by getting people together in their local communities and doing conversations in the community. How do we set up little informal kind of community assemblies so that we can discuss stuff together? How do we do our school PNCs in more democratic ways? And that starts to flow through so that it improves democracy without even having to talk to people about the fact that we're improving democracy. And that's what I'm really trying to think about in the very closely related question of climate and ecological crises as well. It's really hard to convince people of something. It's really easy, actually, to get people involved in fun activities. And when they're involved in fun activities, whether it's getting together to do community renewable energy cooperatives or insulate houses together, practices of doing weatherization, practices of community food, rewilding in the community, all sorts of stuff like that. That's just a lot of fun and it's engaging. And people will do it whether they believe it's necessary or not, because it's a fun practice. And that way we start to get to transformation much faster than we can do it if we try to keep bashing on people's doors and try to convince them of stuff that they're just not ready to believe.
Have you got a couple of concrete examples you can put before us?
Well, I think it's interesting. I was thinking about the rewilding one. There's been some really powerful reportage recently on how areas that have been rewilded, where they've been reintroducing beavers, for instance, who are doing what beavers do. They're damming up the creeks and they're naturally creating wetlands. And then there's more plants that are growing on the edges of the creeks and you've got less erosion happening and you've got all of a sudden this beautiful kind of repopulation of the natural environment. And what they're finding is that in the midst of the worst drought in, 200 years and possibly much, much longer, the areas that have been rewilded are so much more robust and healthy than the areas which are not, which are currently under intensive farming, which shouldn't really be a surprise. It's kind of obvious that that's the case. But what I think is really important in the context of this conversation as well is that the rewilding isn't something that we're doing because, or it is being done because people have lobbied governments to do it. It's being done because people are just getting out there and doing it themselves. And whether they believe it's kind of for climate or the environment or not, in fact, a lot of it is kind of on the basis of interesting sort of old patriotism. We want the England of how it used to be sort of thing. And people are just doing it. So I think that's a really powerful example of it. I think, you know, you folks have spoken a lot as well to the people down in Indi in northern Victoria, and there's a lot going on there that's really interesting as well, not just the famous Voices for Indi kind of independent political project, but things like 100% renewable or totally renewable Yakandanda, a small town down there near Wangaratta, where the local communities got together and they've just decided we're going to make our community 100% renewables, and they're doing it without really much or any kind of government support or control. And people who have really vastly different opinions about the environment and climate and politics are doing it because it's a good community activity. It's saving them money. They like it. It's bringing them together. It's just good stuff. So that, I think, is the really interesting thing going on there, that like you can move away from fossil fuels, not by convincing people that fossil fuels are bad, but by getting people together and saying, hey, how about we do a local community microgrid here based on renewables and batteries? And here's how it's going to work. Do you want to come and get involved? A much more kind of emergent, constructive way of going about things suddenly becomes possible if we take that approach.
I can see how that would work at a community level, Tim, but how do you get, for example, our federal government to bring in measures that would stop us exporting our gas around the world and exporting our coal around the world, which is putting CO2 in the atmosphere for which we don't even get credited?
I don't think we're going to convince our federal government to do that. I honestly don't. There's absolutely no signal that this set of politicians within this system of politics is able to do it. So, again, I think what we need to do is on the ground. We need to be there on the ground blockading some of these sites. We need to be in the foyers of the banks and the corporations that are doing it and blockading them and turning away their funders and actually doing it ourselves. And we need to be out, and which is something that many people in the community are doing. We need to be out in the customer countries as well, working with other communities, grassroots communities in those countries, supporting them in their projects to stop these imports from their perspective going ahead.
So it's a whole systemic change then, Tim?
Yeah, I think this is the really important thing that I've come to think about in the last little while. As you said, I've been on your show a number of times. People know, if you've heard me or read what I write, I've been involved in politics for a long time, 25 years. I've been a staffer in federal parliament. I've been a candidate for the federal parliament. I am very convinced now that pathway is broken to the extent that it ever worked. And it only ever worked for a very kind of given meaning of worked. To the extent that it ever did, it doesn't work anymore. And I think that's one of the things that we need to let go of. We need to let, I'm not saying that we need to stop involvement with it altogether, to be very clear. But what I'm saying is that what's really happened, and it's actually increased over the period of time when the whole system's working less and less and less, ironically, it's increased the extent to which kind of almost the whole environment and climate movement in a country like Australia just only thinks in electoral terms. We're pretty convinced that the only way we can make change is by convincing government to do it at a time when it's increasingly obvious that government won't do it. So what we need to do is rebuild our democratic systems from the grassroots up. We need to build truly democratic systems. We need to be holding the pressure on those systems as they exist and trying, not giving up, trying, but doing so with a commitment that we understand it won't work, and this is about actually demonstrating what might work instead.
Ground is moving, the old ways aren't working. We keep holding tighter, it's time to release them.
get to know each other's names on the ground. We don't wait for permission on the ground. We practice the world we want to become. Neighbors, gardens, repair cafes, food, trees, conversations, change is something you do. Kinder, better listeners, improvisations on the ground. We get our hands in the dirt on the ground. We get to know each other's names on the ground. We don't wait for permission on the ground. We practice the world we want to become. No map for what comes next. We practice what comes next.
Have you found, Tim, in communities that have taken the change into their own hands, like Yakandanda, have you found that they then change their voting habits too? Is there any way of measuring that?
So the evidence in Yakandanda and Indi is that they do go quite neatly hand in hand. That when you get people building community together doing this work, they're more open to voting for candidates who are more committed to that kind of work and to community, which tends to be independents and Greens. There is also, actually, evidence that it doesn't always happen. There are some really fantastic projects around the Hay Plain, for instance, in southern New South Wales. Really great projects that's not that far from Indi, getting people to think more deeply about renewables and engage in that. And in those places, they're still voting for One Nation, or they're voting more for One Nation. So it doesn't necessarily go together. Which kind of emphasises my point, I guess, that we could actually, we can get more done in community than perhaps we can politically. And one of the reasons I think about this, and this is kind of at the core of my research, is that the way we're asked to think about the world is radically different if you're thinking about it in terms of electoral politics or if you're thinking about it in terms of your local community and your neighbours and your friends. And when we think about electoral politics, there's a couple of things going on. One is that it's entirely adversarial. It's a fight. It's a battle. And when you put things in terms of a battle, people think aggressively and they think against each other. And that leads to more voting in those ways. But the other thing that's going on is that we're told in this world that the only way we can make change in our communities is by voting. That's the only way we can have power and agency is by voting. And yet the very clear evidence in our lives is that that doesn't actually make any change at all. We vote in a new government and the policies don't change. So electoralism is really deeply, deeply disempowering, ironically, and people don't feel like they have control, and they're right. And what happens when people don't feel like they're in control? They tend to vote for the far right. So even if you can kind of build community engagement, when the question is electoral, they might still go that way. It's a big challenge.
Tim, in your research, have you noticed any differences between men and women? You speak about aggression, and from America, we get all these masculinity movements, even all the way at the top of the American government.
So, yes, is the short answer. The longer answer is there's a long way still to go in my research, but many of the practices that I'm looking at are practices that do tend to be dominated by women, practices of consensus decision-making, for instance, practices of community care, and they tend to be led by women. And that's what we, you know, it's no coincidence, I guess, that the Greens as a party have always been majority female, and the independence movement, the community independence movement, is massively overrepresented by women. So I think there is something definitely there. That said, it's very easy to kind of essentialize that and say, well, men are men and women are women. And I just don't believe that. It's very much socialized. And, you know, I as a facilitator of consensus decision making, for one thing, am often in spaces that are very female, and you know, and I'm there as a man, in the same way that as a violin and viola player, I've often been in places that have been mostly female, and there's nothing to say that violinists should be mostly women. So I think it's really important that we don't kind of over essentialize it, but that we do recognize that the way Western modernity has defined masculinity is highly problematic, and that the pathway that we need to take needs to challenge that.
So let's talk a little bit about that pathway. I'm interested, obviously, I'm biased here because I just wrote a book called Manner of Earth, which is about this topic, and I'm really curious to find pathways, for instance, to talk with men about this, because as you say, the men are not showing up for the meetings.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, in terms of the pathways, as I said, like, I'm increasingly kind of, as a political communicator by trade, I'm increasingly skeptical of political communication as a tool, and that what we need to do is practice, literally practice. And again, as a musician, I think about practice a lot and what it means. That practice means kind of going over stuff over and over and over again and learning how to do something. And we tend to practice, even in our movements for change. I think the climate movement has for a long time in Australia been practicing adversarial electoral politics. We've been practicing having fights with people and trying to convince them about stuff, which isn't working. Yeah. What if we practiced instead how we do good decision making together? What if we practiced how we grow food together? What if we practiced doing bush regen and rewilding? What if we practiced mechanisms of care and community support and mutual aid and all of these kinds of things, and we bring men into that, as you know, wherever we possibly can? We make the invitation, and we make the invitations as enticing as possible. So sometimes, perhaps, thinking about that, bush regen is something that men often get involved in. Because it feels physical, and young men who might otherwise be attracted potentially to the manosphere, bringing them together, doing bush regen, and having conversations while doing it, and then sitting around a campfire or whatever it is at the end of the day, and chatting, and learning about how you actually make collective decisions together. Okay, where are we going to go next? What are the options? What are the pros and cons? How do you feel about that? How do you feel about that? Let's listen to each other and learn. And similarly with kind of some of the other ideas, like, you know, repair cafes and other kind of more, perhaps more physical engagement with these kinds of challenges. There are all sorts of pathways in. And if we practice not just the skills of what we're actually doing in those places, but at the same time we're practicing the skills of being together in a different way, being with each other in a different way and listening and learning together, I think that's a really transformative path. And just a slight shift in our balance away from constantly kind of fighting over elections, just, you know, next year, 10% of that effort we put into mutual aid and bush regen and democracy. And then the next year, 20% we shift across that way. And we start to learn how to do things differently. And we start to practice those skills, and all of a sudden change.
Yes, we've had, actually, the last 3 weeks we've had guests on the program who've all come up with a similar theme of what we need now is kindness.
Yeah.
And you're now pointing that kindness and saying, hey, this is a way of achieving change.
Can I then say that I think we also need physical places where this can happen. I'm in Denmark right now, and I see in the constructions of buildings and roads, it appears to me the Danes have thought more about creating some common space, some community space, where they actually hold weekly events, monthly events, and annual events, where they come together in the community. And maybe that's something we need to think about as well, because I can tell personally from my own street, we don't have anywhere where we could meet, except on the street.
I absolutely agree, 100%. And I think the two go together. We can design public space for kindness, or we can design public space for selfishness. And Australia has unfortunately followed the US and Britain in designing public space recently, mostly for selfishness. And we need those spaces. And again, like I was saying with the rewilding, you know, a lot of that's just up to us. We don't need to ask government for that. We don't need to, you know, try to change policy about that. We just need to gather and make the space. And some of it is really, really hyper, hyper local. Inviting people over for dinner, or inviting people over to cook together. Or if you've got a patch of land, to, you know, to dig up your lawn and plant some food, and just get on with it. And I think really in terms of kindness, it's always been important, hasn't it? It's always been important, but it's only going to get so much more important as the crises roll one after another. And it's also something that actually humans are really, really good at during moments of crisis, which is one of the reasons I actually hold on to a lot of optimism. I'm not going to say hope. I'm going to say optimism, because humans are really good at caring for each other in moments of crisis. And if we recognize those crises, then that's spaces for kindness, and then spaces for you know, developing more physical spaces for kindness.
And there's an extra element here, Tim, we need to think about. The robots are coming. The machines are taking jobs. And human beings will need to figure out what we do with our time and each other in the future. I can report from Denmark. Yesterday on the news was a report that robots now run faster than human beings. And they look, you know, they have two legs, two arms, and something like a face. Here in Denmark, there are robots putting commodities in the shops up on the shelves. That's something, you know, young boys and girls used to do. Now it's robots doing it. I think this is really important when we talk about community, because in community lies also something that is really important that we can do as humans while the robots are taking our jobs.
Right. It's actually, if that happens in that way, it's in some ways a tremendous opportunity to reclaim our time and reclaim our agency and our power to do stuff together in the community. Because one of the extraordinarily powerful things about late capitalism has been how it's just stolen our time. And if we can get some of that back, well, what becomes possible? The other thing that I think about the robots and about AI that draws it back to kind of where I started is that, yeah, it's there sitting alongside the climate and ecological crisis having arrived, and the massive, massive disruptions in our democratic systems that we're seeing from the rise of the far right, and the bare knuckle, completely blatant corruption of so much of our political system, as a really clear signal that the world that we are living in 2026 is not the world that we were living in 2025. And it's so far from the world that we were living in 2015 or 2005 or 1995. The world is completely different. And we haven't really engaged with that. We haven't really thought about the fact that that means we have to change the way we do things. We have to change the way the movement works. I've been a participant in the climate movement in Australia since the late 1990s. And most of what we're doing is kind of the same. And that's not good enough when the world has changed completely around us. We need to let go. We need to let go of what it was before and start thinking about how we work and campaign and live together in the world that's actually here.
Tim, thank you so much for really taking us somewhere new. This has been so inspiring, and that'll be all we can fit in this particular hour, but this will continue. Sustainable Hour after Sustainable Hour, we're going to explore more of this, and we would love to hear more from you when you come back with more research and more findings. What should we be, Tim?
What should we be is exactly the question. That is exactly the question that I'm playing with. And I'm writing a lot about at my blog at In Between Days as I do my research. What should we be? Rather than what do we need to do, who do we need to become? Who do we need to become as a movement, as a community, as individuals? We need to be kinder. We need to be listening better. We need to be flexible. We need to improvise. We need to kind of learn how to jam our way into whatever comes next. That's exciting.
And it brings us back to the good old Be the Change.
Be the Change.
I woke up feeling like the world's on fire. Storms are rising, rivers running drier. But then I tuned in, turned the dial, and found a reason to stay inspired. They said the greatest threat is thinking someone else will do it. But I can feel the change. I know we're moving through it.
Time is running out.
I heard it on the Sustainable Hour. Hope for life and the time is now.
Carry on just being the difference.
They talk of profits, pipelines and delay. Though we got voices that won't fade away.
To see and understand the bigger
picture. From city streets to the coastal sand. We're backing leaders to take a stand. They said as society grows green, we plant trees in whose shade we may.
The difference.
You can do it.
A new industrial revolution powered by millions of sustainable innovations is essential.
Unite in a national effort to save from destruction all that makes life itself worth living.
The biggest concern is that we're facing the potential of an ungovernable state unless government takes this seriously.
So I'm often asked, could these European-style mega-floods happen here? The honest answer is yes.
We're running an increasing risk of these tipping points, including this critical one for the UK. In London, it's minus 20 degrees C in 3 frozen months of the year. And in Edinburgh, it's minus 30 degrees C in 5.5 frozen months of the year.
And I'm talking about the increasing pressure on global food supplies in the face of accelerating climate change and nature loss. And when families can't afford to feed their children, societies break down. We see this all the time.
I'm 63. I may not have that much longer left on the planet, but I'm scared for my own life and future, and I'm absolutely terrified for that of my son, and you should be too.
A safer future is still possible, but it requires urgency, coordination, and sustained investment.
But there is also good opportunity. If we do treat this as the security challenge it is, the solutions make us stronger.
Humanity is speeding past the limit to avoid climate catastrophe. 10 years ago in Paris, leaders pledged to limit temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the threshold scientists say is critical to avoiding the worst climate devastation. The latest report from the UN Environment Programme delivers a stark warning. The world is failing to keep that promise. We are set to breach the 1.5 degree limit within the next few years. And this summer's scorching heat, raging wildfires and deadly floods are a warning of what lies ahead. Every fraction of a degree will cost lives, destroy livelihoods, deepen inequality, and push ecosystems closer to irreversible damage. But we can still bring warming back below 1.5 degrees by the end of the century. We must make the overshoot as small and short as possible, limiting how high temperatures rise and how long they remain above 1.5. That demands an overshoot of ambition, accelerating the phase-out of fossil fuels and renewables revolution, slashing methane pollution, and protecting land, forests, and oceans. Governments must over-deliver on national climate plans, net-zero commitments, and beyond. And developed countries must triple adaptation finance and ensure it reaches those most at risk. The science is clear. The solutions are at hand. And the world has never been better equipped to deploy them. Now is the time to raise ambition and accelerate action.
People keep asking me how to electrify their homes. Now, I could lecture you on the thermodynamics, I could talk to you about the economics and why it will save you money, I could talk to you about the health benefits and why it's good for you, your kids and your pets. But really, there's just millions of Australian households trying to get off gas, and there's only one of me.
Hey Saul, I'm you. But I don't need coffee. And I can help countless families at any one time.
Bloody hell, that's deeply unsettling. Wait. Can you build an electric hydrofoil out of recycled parts from this office space?
No. But I can help a family in Dubbo calculate the money they can save with a solar-powered EV in 4 milliseconds.
Well, okay. That's actually very useful.
Your gas heater is a money pit. Switch to a heat pump. Save about $1,200 a year.
Wait, are you going to replace me?
No, silly. I'm answering the 10,000 questions across Australia that you don't have time for.
He's annoying, but he's right.
Get your plan. Start saving. Try Electric Soul today.
Climate change absolutely impacts every part of the human body. It really is one of the true existential threats to human health of this century. Hi, I'm Eugenie Kayak. I'm Enterprise Professor in Sustainable Healthcare at the Melbourne Medical School and a practicing anaesthetist in Melbourne. And importantly, I'm convener of Doctors for the Environment Australia's Sustainable Healthcare Special Interest Group. And I've been involved in DEA for almost 20 years now. So we as medical professions, I think it's really important for us to get that message out that climate change is a health issue. It's an all-encompassing health issues. We might hear about how it impacts the environment and the economy and industry, but ultimately it falls down to how it impacts our health and well-being. There's no body system or organ system that isn't impacted impacted potentially from our accelerated climate change. So as doctors and other health professionals, we really have an important message to get across when it comes to action on climate change. And I think probably most importantly also is that, you know, mitigating greenhouse gas emissions has many potential more immediate health co-benefits. And so there are advantages to human health, to population health, with decreasing air pollution from fossil fuel combustion, from improving our diet so it's more plant-based, from active transport. What drives me and keeps me going is, one, the benefits of acting on climate change, but also that, you know, it is preventable. It is not black and white. We can mitigate and minimise the impacts of climate change. We have the tools to change things around.
Hey man, look at that.
Whoa, it's beautiful,
right? And if I clear cut it, I can make a 7% yield.
But then the forest will be gone.
And then you use the profits to diversify your portfolio and start a fishing operation to take all the fish from the ocean.
But then there would be no fish.
But then you use the 10% profit margin to build a power plant to burn the coal you mine where the forest used to be.
But then the air will be ruined too.
But business has never been better. And we'll use the useless land we logged and killed and sucked dry to build...
affordable housing?
Chuck E. Cheese! Franchises! Applebee's, Starbucks, Dutch Bros, GameStop, Chipotle, Panda Express... Chipotle.
Wait, but without any clean water or green anywhere, what will people eat?
Chips!
But from where?
Somewhere else. And we'll just keep taking and taking, and the profits will grow faster and faster,
no.
And it'll never stop. It's infinite. It's infinite. It's infinite.
No, it's not.
Why not?
Because the world isn't. You can't keep taking more and more when you've destroyed the only planet we have.
But what about growth?
Well, a system built on infinite growth just doesn't work in a finite world.
But if you can't keep getting more, what's the point?
Well, that's easy. It's to take care of what you have.
Oh, yeah.
As someone who's worked in climate for many years, let me explain why this graph is the most important thing you will see this year. And maybe the scariest, but let's just start with important. So this is essentially the overshoot graph that came from the United Nations Environmental Programme report, which is being called the overshoot report because it is basically guaranteeing that we are going to overshoot the 1.5 degree temperature increase goal above pre-industrial levels that we set at the Paris Climate Accords. Now, why does this matter? Because this graph is basically a choose your own adventure of what the world is going to look like if we act now and if we don't. Because if we choose not to act, not to decarbonize the grid, to protect nature at scale, to do the things that we know would work, the world is going to look pretty dicey in 5 or 10 years, not 30 years, not 50 years. I mean, look at this summer and the fires and the floods and the heat waves. This is the time to act. And this is where, honestly, someone who works in climate, like, I'm fired up. This is the opportunity for us to actually do what we know is necessary, and we know what's going to work. And that's the craziest thing about, you know, climate. Is we know exactly how to solve this problem. We know how to decarbonize the grid. We know how to decarbonize industry. We know how to preserve and protect nature at scale so it can sequester more carbon back into the earth. And so this graph is the most important thing you will see this year and should be the most inspiring because it shows that we can solve this problem if we act now. So if you're in climate, if you're doing the work, let's go.